Human Services to order. We have just under 2 hours to go through an agenda. I want to welcome everyone here, and I first want to announce that Senate Bill 1100 will not be heard today. It will be heard on Friday, first thing. Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson will be able to be on a conference call, and there appears to be some opposition, so I want to make sure that he hears all of the testimony. With that, again, welcome everyone. I'm delighted to be here and really hope that we can get some good legislation through. I do want to have the rules taken care of since we have a quorum, and so I'd like to open an organizational meeting, and if I could have a motion.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules for the 2008 special session.
Senator Gordley moves to adopt the proposed committee rules for the 2008 special session. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. Now I would like each of the members of the committee to introduce themselves, please, and we'll start with Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, Lane County, parts of Lane County and Linn County. I'm from Springfield.
Good morning, Madam Chair and colleagues. I am Abel Gordley, representing Senate District 23, Northeast, Southeast Portland, Multnomah County.
Senator Carter?
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Margaret Carter. I'm a member of Senate District 22, Northeast Portland. And I'm glad to be on the committee with you again.
Thank you. I'm Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, Coosa, Curry counties, and it's old home week here, so.
Great. And I'm Senator Lori Monis Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale Village, and Fairview. And I'm delighted to be here, too, and I would also like to introduce Chris Swift. He is sitting at my left here. He is a student from San Barlow High School and is job shadowing me. And Chris, would you like to say a few words?
I would like to thank the Senator Monis Anderson for allowing me to have this opportunity and the rest of the committee for allowing me to sit in. I'm here today job shadowing the senator because I'm really interested potentially in a career in civil service. And I think that as a young student and as kind of the future, part of the future of this area and of the country, that it's important for me to become politically involved and kind of have some knowledge of the workings of my government. So that's why I'm here today.
Great. Glad to have you. We really want our youth to get engaged. So glad to have you here. All right. With that, I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1093. Doc Bates and Tina Edlin.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Doc Bates, Senator Alan Bates from Southern Oregon. Yeah, better known as the doc around here. We'll just leave it that way for everybody. But for the record, I'm actually a senator. And Tina, would you like to introduce yourself? Mm-hmm.
For the record, I'm Tina Edlin. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the Office of Health Policy and Research, and I'm here on behalf of Barney Spate, the Executive Director of the Health Fund Board.
And the first thing I'd ask you to do is completely ignore 1093's original language. This is a stuff and gut. And,
stuff and gut.
Okay. And I guess we'll have to gut and stuff for first. Yeah. Whatever way it works.
For a surgeon, you got to get it
yeah.
right.
Occasionally, I felt surgeries went that way, and it's always difficult. Anyway, the original bill was actually put in place and asked for a very wide relating clause in case we ran into something in this session that we actually needed to fix. And fortunately or unfortunately, that's exactly the way it worked out. So the relating clause in this bill is relating to health. And I hadn't even planned to use the bill unless something came up. About 3 weeks ago, we found out that in Senate Bill 329, the bill that we passed last session to begin the process of reform of the health care delivery system in this state had at least two flaws in it that we did not realize were there at the time we passed the bill. The first flaw was that the monies that had been allocated for this board and this this committee to work with over the next 18 months from the time we left were tied up in a way that they couldn't use it. We had specifically stated that we did not want to go through the normal contracting rules that the state uses for two reasons. One was a time element. We wanted to report back to the next session. We couldn't do that with the normal RFP process that's used by the state. And so that authority was given to the health fund board to use that money more in the way that a business community uses the money. We found out from the Attorney General that we did not, in fact, get that done that way, and this bill fixes that problem by moving it from one fund to the second fund and in the bill, which allows it to be used the way it was first intended to be used. So the first part of this moves the $400,000 of general fund money to the second fund. It also opens that second fund up to a larger appropriation. We're getting money now for this effort from outside groups. We received $186,000 from the Robert Wood Johnson Fund to help with the work they want to do as far as outreach is concerned and bringing what we call the pro from Dover, in other words, actuarial people who can look at these numbers. We're going to have to crunch for this to report back to the legislature what some of these programs would cost or how we'd save money. So that solves two problems. The third issue is a boilerplate one. When you write these laws, you normally put in the right for the committee or the task force to formulate rules so they can work and get the job done. The rules are specific just for that bill. That boilerplate was failed to be put into this bill, and we're now reinserting it in the bill so it's there. That was really a drafting oversight that wasn't done. So that's what this bill does. That's what the new language does, and I'm hoping that you'll look on it favorably. Tina, do you want to add anything?
I think the only other piece is that he's also asked for changing the date on the reporting out of one of the committees to align it with the rest of the report, which is October 1st. That way we can run all of our public hearings and do our public outreach at the same time and save money and effort.
Right. Is there any discussion or questions on this? Just a quick question. How are we proceeding? Will you be reporting back during this session on 329 to, and who would you be?
There is a written report already was turned in yesterday to leadership in both sides, the House and the Senate. And in the Health Reform Committee, we spent 3 hours yesterday going over where the work is right now, how far they progressed with the subcommittees and the committees, and where we expect them to be in October. At the present time, they're on target for the task they've put before them. They have a lot of very hard work to do. They're going to be out in September and October doing a lot of interaction with the public and meetings across the state. They're formulating right now in the subcommittees the proposals they think need to be going forward. Some of those committees are quite large. As an example, the delivery committee is 19 members. The finance committee is, I think, 7 or 8. They're working through some real tough issues, the ones we asked them to look at, and bring forward from those subcommittees to the board their proposals for fixing the system. And the board will then bring those proposals all back to us as a package, which we will have to make some decisions on in the next session in 2009.
Great. Thank you. Yes. Senator Cruz.
Dr. Bates, how are you going to proceed if a subcommittee does not reach consensus?
Subcommittee can't reach consensus. The board will have to step in and reach that consensus for them. The authority rests in the board. Hopefully they will reach those consensus, but as you know, Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, it might not reach consensus. It is possible some of those people cannot reach a consensus on some really tough issues.
And there's a couple that I think that's probably the reality, so from what I've been hearing. So.
Okay. Okay, well, we will have an update on 329 informational, depending on the schedule. Mm-hmm. So we will be able to
address
it.
When we have nothing else to do.
When we have nothing else to do.
I didn't want us to step anybody's toes by saying that we were wanting to give that to you in the third week of the session, but we didn't know what your schedule was, and I wasn't going to suggest that publicly until I had talked to the chair.
Sandy will let us know when it can be scheduled. All right. Okay. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1093, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 1093. Do I hear a motion?
Senate Bill 1.
Dash one amendment. Yes, one.
Please.
I'm nervous.
I can't vote for the original bill.
I can't either.
I move dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1093. Okay, Senator Carter moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1093. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Okay, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1093 to the floor as amended.
Is that
referral? The subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Carter moves Senate Bill 1093 as amended to the floor with the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter?
Right, yeah.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gordley?
Aye.
Chair
Monahan? Aye. Senate Bill 1093 has passed. All right. Now, we close the work session on Senate Bill 1093, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1089. Senator Bates?
Oh, that's me.
Senator Carter.
And Senator Carter.
Yeah, let her go, too.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the work on 1089. Appreciate it.
Madam Chair.
1093, I mean. Thank you.
While we're waiting for them to settle, I'd like to make an introduction if I may. I see in our audience this morning a dynamic, outstanding civic leader. I'm speaking of Marcus Mundy, who is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Urban League. Welcome. It's wonderful to see you this morning.
Welcome. Glad to have you here. All right. With that, Senator Carter.
Madam Chair, I'm so glad the Senate Wardley has better eyes than I do, and I'd like to welcome our President here as well. Thank him for coming from the Urban League. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Carter. I represent Senate District 22 in North Northeast Portland. I'm proud to be joined and introduced this legislation with Senator Bates because I think it's that piece of legislation that says that it's been a long time coming and that now is the right time to do it. Last year, I held, Madam Chair, as you recall, because you were in attendance, and thank you for having been there. We held a symposium on mental health in Portland under the auspices of the National Organization of Black Elected Legislative Women, for which I am the president. One of our key speakers was Dr. Roger Cathol, and he really, really caught my eye and my ear in listening very well to some of his comments. Dr. Cathol is an internist and a psychologist, and one of the leading analysts in the nation on mental and physical health. His work was recommended to us by the world-famous Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and he was listened to very attentively by other medical people in our state and in our city who had heard of his great work. And he presented some of his findings that indicated cost savings and efficiencies in better care, in particular for minorities, from greater integration and coordination of the various spheres of care. And we need to look at that because we could have cost savings there because we use our emergency room on too many different occasions for physical health things when in reality they are mental health. He talked about how we need to look at the correction system as well because many of the people that are there are a part of mental health care needs, and a community system would do a better job than putting our people into corrections. He was unequivocally excited about the fact that we know that our prisons have become repositories for some citizens that really do need better health care. We're paying $27,500 or more. I'm just using that number because it's an old number, but I hope it's not much more, but I think it is, per bed for a person to be in our prison system, whereas if this person would have, we had community systems available in our community, the cost would be 50 times less than what this is. And so we need to do a better job of knowing how do we do a better job of how our community systems operate and what they can do better than what we are doing right now because we don't fund them. In addition, he was saying there is rising evidence of gaps in care for returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan and high incident rates of mental illness. I don't know about others, but I do know about this committee, how we have worked very hard on veterans' issues and looking at our returning veterans. In most instances, they're our babies. These kids are 19 and 20 years of age, and that's our next generation, and we just cannot leave this care just going out there someplace and our kids coming back home and we don't provide care for them. That's going to be a need for our mental health, our community mental health system as well. We also had data presented from Minnesota and reforms in their state system for 2007. Senate Bill 1089 calls for looking at the gaps in the delivery of care to see what we can learn from examining the existing inefficiencies and help us to develop a guide, a way to better improvements. This bill is timely, in particular, as we are currently assessing care and deficiencies at the state hospital and other realms as we move forward to implement wider coverage such as Senate Bill 1, mental health parity. We need to be looking at the total system that we call mental health care in this state. Examination of that system, of the system that we have today, is helpful in providing us as policymakers, providers, and advocates with accurate, unbiased information. Information crucial to decisions and investments that we make. And investments is a key word here. We cannot keep throwing money at bad systems. We must have some means of being able to capture and to manage better the opportunity that we have in this state. It's not enough to receive a ding from the federal government, and then we go and we get DHS as legislators, and we say the fault is yours, Dr. Goldberg, and you need to have a better management system, but we need to know how much it costs to have that better management system, and we need to make sure that we put the resources there to have a better outcome. And it is vital that we provide appropriate and effective services. The study will give us insight into what we're actually spending our money on, the uncoordinated dollars. I don't know about you, my pocketbook does not want to continue to use to pay taxes for uncoordinated services in this state. We need to provide in the community to help the veterans coming home and efficiencies in care for those most vulnerable. And, Madam Chair, with that, my colleague, Dr. Bates, will have some comments. And I hope, even though that these were kind of hard words to us as a body, but I would hope that we heed them because we do not know how much the system costs and where we're throwing bad money, I mean good money at bad services. Thank you, Dr. Bates.
Thank you, Senator Carter. Dr. Bates.
Senator Carter, for the record, Doc Bates again, Senator from Southern Oregon. I came with this from two different positions. One, as a veteran from Vietnam and watching what happened to Vietnam veterans when they came back to this country after the war and the mental health problems they had that were not addressed either by the VA system or by the local systems at that time. And I believe we're going to be running the same thing again. The VA has vastly improved their ability to deal with these situations and are much, much, much better at doing it. But many of these men and women will be coming into communities where the VA is simply not available to them. They'll be in rural parts of the United States, rural parts of our state, and it'll be hours and hours and hours or hundreds of miles from them to get any mental care from the VA, and they're going to fall back on our local community systems. So that's what this talks about as far as veterans are concerned. The other issue here, and I come from a little different perspective on this, is that we are ready to engage ourselves in a massive rebuilding of something that needs to be done, a new mental health facility for the state, possibly two. The cost for each one of those beds is in the neighborhood of over $200,000 a year. I believe that system, as soon as it's rebuilt and in place, will be immediately overrun by more patients they can possibly handle if we do not change our community health care system as far as mental health is concerned. Senator Gordley has led the battle on this for the last year and a half and has worked day and night for this. We were sorely going to miss her in 2009 when she's not there, and the others of us have to pick this banner up and start carrying it. And this is part of picking that banner up, and I just wanted to take a moment and thank Senator Gordon publicly for the work she's done for this. And got us to the point where we're talking about things we should have been talking about before we even talked about the hospital. So what is it like right now for a mental health patient who is not in the system or is in a system that's inadequate? I'm talking about what it's like in Southern Oregon and what it's like across the state. Saturday night, it's 2:00 in the morning. That patient ran out of their antipsychotic medications 2 or 3 days earlier, and they wander into the ER, usually being brought in by the police for strange behavior in the street. Hopefully, they have not committed a crime while they were disordered in time, place, and person. Maybe they have, and maybe they went to jail instead and filled our jails up. But usually, they come to the emergency room. They then get admitted to the hospital onto a wing that is for the mentally ill. They're held there for 3, 4, 5, 6 days while they get back on their medications. And then they are adjudicated whether they should go on to the state hospital, which they usually don't go to because there's no place for them to go there. And they're put back out in the street with 5 days of medicine and told to go to your community health department and get your mental health taken care of there. The important for that is usually 2 or 3 weeks out, they run out of medication, and lo and behold, 2 weeks later, they're back in the emergency room. And the same cycle goes on and on and on. This is a common thing that happens. Commonly also, when I've been in this position, when that patient hits the ER and needs to be admitted to the hospital, we find out there's no beds in that particular hospital. So we put them in an ambulance and take them from, say, Medford to Bend. Maybe we take them up to Portland. Maybe Portland's filled up and they're sending people down to us because we've got one bed available. This stuff goes on all the time. It's called working hard but not working smart. We need to start working smart. We know there are best practices out there, commonly called wraparound practices, that make a huge difference. We need to put those in place across the state. We need to get these people the kind of care they really need on a day-to-day basis, a 24/7 basis, keep them out of our ERs, keep them out of our jails, keep them out of our state mental hospital, and keep them in our communities. And we are capable of doing that, but we have to know where to invest that money to do it, as well as have the money to invest to do it. We know in a very rough way how much we need to invest, but frankly, I'm not sure we know exactly which community needs which program and how robust that program is in each community. And that's what this bill is about. This bill is about taking a good, tight, close look at each community, seeing what their needs really are, where they're at with their program, and what that program has to do to change, to take care of the problems we're facing.
Dr. Bates, it's almost 10:30, and Dr. Goldberg has to leave at 10:30, just as you. Can we bring him up, too?
And I'm wrapping right now.
Okay.
So the importance of this bill is getting a good, tight look at those local communities and seeing what the need really is, quantitating it, and bringing it back to the Oneida legislature.
Thank you so much.
Didn't mean to cut you out, Bruce.
Oh, no. It's a pleasure to join you.
All right, and we're also evidently, General Caldwell needs to step out quickly, too. So, all right. Thanks.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg. I'm the director of the Department of Human Services and here to testify in strong support of Senate Bill 1089. I think what you've heard already from both Senator Carter and Senator Bates, as well as from the work of Senator Gordley throughout the years, is that we've certainly created a system in this state, but for caring for individuals with mental illness, but that system is inadequate. It's not meeting the needs. And I think that that's the place that we all tend to agree on, that we've seen the stories, the examples, the human lives that have been shattered and affected by this. But where I don't think we have the agreement yet is around the scope of that problem, how big those gaps are, where the problems are, and until we know that, until we know exactly how many people in this state are not getting the mental health care that they need, where they're not getting it, what needs to be done to narrow those gaps, we will never be able to move forward in an intelligent and meaningful way. And I believe that what this bill does is really start us down that path to developing a common understanding of the scope of this problem. When we do that, we can then have, I think, the kinds of discussions we need to have based on clear, concise, accurate information. Once we know the scope of the problem, we can then all together talk about what the appropriate solutions are. But until we all have that understanding, I think that we're going to just continue to reiterate what the problems are. So I think this is a wonderful step forward. I think it's what we need. It's what we as in the Department of Human Services would do if we had the resources to do. We stand ready to participate in this and to be able to help provide some of the accurate, fact-based information that we all need to be able to move forward in a meaningful way that's going to improve people's lives.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. And I want a task force or a study, basically. This is a study to mean something. I took a look from 2001 to the present. We've had 8 studies on mental health, starting with the Governor's Mental Health Alignment Work Group, DHS description, House Bill 3024. We have Governor's Mental Health Task Force report. We have the quality reports commissioned by AMH, PSU's eval of the Children's System Change Initiative, the Community Services report, Kids Wraparound report. Is this just going to be another report, or are we truly going to be able to see change? And I quote Senator Courtney, President Courtney, when he was at the psychiatric hospital, the evaluation that we had on the care that's being given at the psychiatric hospital. We've been giving the department money, and yet the system is just not changing. And so can you guarantee that this study is going to really cause a change that's going to be meaningful so we have quality care for our mental health people?
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I think it's going to take all of us to make that guarantee, not just myself. This is about what policymakers do. This is about the type of policy, the type of funding, the type of systems that we create in this state. And that's something that I personally can't guarantee is going to happen. What I can personally guarantee is the commitment to do everything I can to make that happen. I think what makes this different, and you know, I look to the wisdom of both Senator Bates and Senator Carter, this isn't this bill doesn't call for a task force or a report or anything like that, which you cited many of those efforts. What this is something that those task forces have never done, which is to really map out for all of us where our current investments are and where the gaps are. And I think, if I could be so bold as to say, if we had this information and if these task forces had this kind of information to consider, they might have been able to use it as a foundation to be able to create the sort of strategic plan to move us forward, because we would then know exactly where and what to do. So I don't think this is the same endeavor. I think this is the kind of information that you as policymakers need and that we as a department need, and that isn't just about what we in the Department of Human Services do. It's about what we as a state do. There are resources that go into mental health care for veterans, as you'll hear from General Caldwell, in a variety of other places in our community. And what we need to understand is what those assets are, what those gaps are, and then we can talk about how to put that together.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Carter and then Senator
Madam Chair, that's actually a question that I should be answering for you because since I've been working on this issue since 1985. One of the things, the 2006 study Senator Wetters and I asked the governor to do, and 2007 for children, I did along with Dr. Nickel and some other people who were interested in looking at children's mental health. The problem is that we have brought back these studies to the legislature. We as a body have not wanted to do anything. We as a body, I have brought this to the legislature each time, and we couldn't do it. I don't intend to let this piece fall by the wayside because I will be ushering in with members of the community of mental health people that I have been working with, who from the hospital association, some community mental health people, people who are working with me, and actually I've been working with Laura Smith and with Jane from the hospital association and other community mental health people who are interested in knowing what the cost truly is. And are we throwing good money after bad practices? And so we plan to come back to you in 2009 with information from this. We as a legislative body, these guys can't do anything unless we implement the policies, and that's the problem.
Thank you. Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Want to acknowledge and honor the leadership of Senator Carter, Senator Bates, first of all. Also, want to be mindful of Dr. Goldberg's schedule. And appreciating your question, Madam Chair, I had the same question. I appreciate very much that you asked in the way that you did and that we got the great response on the record from Senator Carter. With that said, in all of the studies that you cited, Madam Chair, what we have not looked at deeply in this state is that whole realm of mental health and addiction services for underserved populations, seniors, people with disabilities. Underserved populations, meaning racial and ethnic populations. And as you know, Dr. Goldberg, there's another bill on our agenda coming up, 1075. I'm hoping that you would comment on that bill, its relationship to the bill before us, 1089. Do you see them as complementary, which in my mind they are, but I'd like to hear something on the record from the Department of Human Services in your role looking at the big picture, if you will.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Gordley, members of the committee, I have not read Senate Bill 1075, so I would be very happy to put a comment on the record, but I'd like to have the opportunity to see the bill so I can speak intelligently.
What I will tell you is that this is a bill that also passed.
Since we're limited in time, let's focus on Senate Bill 1089, and we will definitely probably have more conversations on this Friday, and hopefully you'll be here Friday or not.
I'll do my best.
Or a statement. It's a bill that passed last session. So you are familiar.
Okay, so I'd rather stick with 1089 and General Caldwell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, and I'll make this quick. We support this bill wholeheartedly. I think Dr. Bates detailed the real-life issues that are actually going on as we speak. I think for the committee's edification, right now the Oregon National Guard has deployed over 7,000 individuals on the war since the beginning of the war on terror. 9/11, I guess, would be the start date. We have 3,500 men and women who will be deploying in about a year and 2 or 3 months. We're preparing them now to go back to Iraq. So if you do just the raw data, you're up to 8,000-9,000 folks. We don't know. I don't know if there's an empirical study that'll tell you that out of these 9,000 people, you can guarantee or get a percentage. But I suspect somebody's developing those numbers. again, it was clearly identified that the Veterans Affairs, Federal Veterans Affairs, has resources, but they're scattered around the state in some places. They're getting better at it. They're doing a lot better job than they used to do. That still doesn't mean that these folks aren't out there hitting on the very fragile county health system. Having some experience as a county commissioner, I can tell you that from my experience, these county systems cannot absorb this kind of influx if they were to get it, whatever that percentage is. They're right on the edge now. So we need to get the federal government. I think this study, what it'll do, as the doctor said, is not only get us the gaps, but I think it'll prepare us and get us in a position that we can go to the federal government and we can make our case that you're not getting the job done and we need to have these medications either some other way through the county system, to the state system, or some voucher system or something so these people can continue to stay on their meds if they are indeed necessary to do that. So I think what the study will do is give us a launching pad for us to go do our due diligence with the federal government between DHS and our department and ODVA. We can make that case then, and we can say, you guys got to change the program. They've been very receptive, and I think this is the kind of data that we're going to need in order to make that case. We can't just go in and say, we think. We've got to have some data. So I'm very supportive of this, and I think it'll benefit the citizens of Oregon. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Yes.
And Senator Bates was kind enough to refresh my memory about Senate Bill 1075, which creates the Task Force on Mental Health and Addiction Services for Underserved Populations. With that memory refreshment, I would like to comment because I think it's an important issue. And the question from Senator Gordley was the interface between these.
Absolutely.
And to be honest, these are inextricably linked. I don't know how we can have a task force that can do its work on being able to make recommendations about the mental health needs and services for underserved populations without the kind of data and information that shows exactly where the gaps are. So they go hand in hand, and it really is related, Senator Mona Sanderson, to your question about, well, we've had all these task forces, and you know, part of the issue is we don't start with the foundation, which is the sort of fact-based knowledge and information that we need to get to put all this information together, and then look at the good people on a task force like the one being proposed, who can then take that and create some of the solutions. So,
and Madam Chair, I can assure you that this will all be taken in consideration. We have our people that are going to be coming up here speaking to that issue, because we're all about looking at efficiencies.
And we have about 5 minutes to go on this bill, but it looks like it's going to go a little longer.
Madam Chair,
yeah. Senator Cruz.
I just want to say thank the good senators for this, and in all due respect to Senator Bates and his 329 work. I think the most important, the most vital, the number one health care issue for 2009 is mental health, without a question. And this is, you know, and it is up to us. You know, I was on the governor's mental health alignment work group in 2001. Senator Gordon and I were both on it. We created a wonderful report that got totally ignored. Okay, we can't allow that to happen. But I would also submit that when we're talking about the mentally ill in Oregon, we are talking about a minority underserved population, and ethnicity is an issue, but the real issue is they're all poor.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Of whatever race they are, they're all poor. Mm-hmm. And those that are chronically mentally ill are the ones that we are always going to have to take care of. We know that. And I'd also point out that, you know, Alan, you know, behavioral health in Roseburg is gone. We're going to have dominoes here, folks. The whole system is going to break down unless, and I've said this at every meeting in this building during the interim, that this has got to be job one for us in 2009.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Cruz. And I am with you 100%. Okay, let's call up Don Moore from NAMI, Jane Ellen Wyden from the Hospital Association, and Laura Smith from NAMI.
Get some ass here, Margaret.
Yeah, et cetera.
That's right.
And we need to move on quickly.
We will be very quick.
not too quick. We need to vet it. But
we should breathe a little bit while we're testifying.
Yes, yes.
Chairwoman Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, I'm Jane Ellen Widens with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. On behalf of the 57 hospitals that we represent today, thank you for allowing me to testify before you. I also have the pleasure of being the co-convener of the Community Mental Health Coalition of Oregon. You'll remember that organization was active last session in talking to you about the needs of a community mental health system, and I am awed by your dedication and your leadership that you showed during the 2007 session and you continue to show today. So we appreciate your work and will continue to be your partners in doing everything we can to improve the mental health system in Oregon. We appreciate Senator Carter's work here in developing Senate Bill 1089 because we do believe that we need a system that is accountable and transparent to not only you as the policymakers and the representatives of our communities, but also to Oregonians so that we can make intelligent decisions about our community mental health system and the investments we need to make. We're going to be back in 2009. Thank you, Senator Cruz, for the plug. We'll be asking for probably close to $180 million. It's a lot of money, and we know it's a lot of money, but that's what we need. The Community Services Work Group report led by Bob Nickel and many members of the community that are in the audience today identified a fourth biennium investment strategy to get us to where we need to go. But before I come before you and tell you why you need to give us $180 million, I really think that we need this system that will show us comprehensive across all levels of state government, local government, law enforcement, community corrections, and service providers. Everyone, I hate using sports analogies, but I'll use it here. This is everyone has skin in this game, and we all need to be held accountable and all need to be transparent to you so that you can make good policy decisions. This bill will do that. And somebody asked me, why do we need to do this? Why we need to do this is because the community mental health system and all of the linkages and barriers that are all out there is complex. Everyone is doing their best. Everyone is doing what they can, but we don't have a comprehensive overview. And so those linkages that we need to make are very difficult for us to make both in a policy arena and in a service delivery arena. The Department of Human Services is currently doing this with the Department of Corrections on the addiction system, and we have the support of the Department of Corrections on this to do this in the adult mental health system. We think that that's critical, is to look across all those systems. Somebody asked me, well, we've done a lot of task forces before, and we have. They've set policy. They've really said we need to have a community system. We need to do it right. We need to provide people humane services that support them in their communities. This evaluation will bring all of that together and give you the tools you need to make good decisions in the 2009 session. Again, I told you it includes the Department of Corrections. It also includes the Department of Veterans Affairs and cities and counties and all of those local service providers that the system depends upon. And we agree with Senator Gordley that this needs to look at the rural populations and underserved people, both ethnic minorities, seniors, and people with physical disabilities. We need to know exactly what's going on for those individuals. And one of the key points about this is that this will be performed by an independent contractor, an expert. This is not a task force with everyone who has a vested interest sitting at the table telling you then what we need. This is going to be an expert who can evaluate the system and can get us to an accountable system. And the request for this analysis is very small. We're asking for between $150,000 and $200,000. We've vetted that through different providers throughout the country who have done this before. They think that that's a logical amount of money, and we think that we can get you a good product by doing that. And just to summarize, we think you need this analysis because it'll give you the answers that you have desperately needed on the community mental health system in Oregon, and we're here to support that, and we'll be back in 2009 asking for additional investments. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura Smith. I'm here today representing NAMI Oregon and Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare. In addition, I'm a member, co-convener of the Community Mental Health Coalition. I just want to share a little bit with you about what happened in Minnesota when they embarked on a very similar analysis. In the back of Senator Carter's testimony, you can see a fact sheet that kind of talks about the process the progress that they've made since 2006 when they embarked on a process to restructure their mental health system. They started with an analysis exactly like this. It was a snapshot of what was going on in their system, where the dollars were being spent, what was effective, what was not effective. They came back with a report it was a roadmap for them for the 2007 session that not only had investments in their mental health system, but also policy changes that found efficiencies. As a result, they were very, very successful. They had an additional $34 million in investments. They set up a comprehensive benefit set in public health care programs that included assertive community treatment services, which we know are evidence-based practices that work. Every single person who was publicly funded had access to those ACT teams. It's just critical in taking down your costs in the mental health system. They integrated their mental health care with the rest of the health care system. They're still working on that right now, but this really gave them the information and the path that they needed to get to there. They also had an additional $31 million in targeted investments, and much of that was funded by savings that they found through efficiencies by just looking at this report and showing them where their dollars were being wasted. So I encourage you to look closely at that document at the end of Senator Carter's testimony, because it really does show you some of the outcomes that can happen here in Oregon that really can get us to a functioning community mental health system that keeps people out of institutions and treats them in their communities.
Thank you.
With this, I'll pass this over to one of my NAMI members, Mr. Don Moore.
Senator Chair Monis Anderson, senators, appreciate the opportunity to speak before you. I come from a little different perspective, and that is my daughter is mentally ill. And navigating the care system in the case of her, she's a remarkably young lady, but you fight for access to particular things right now.
You need to identify yourself.
Don Moore. Yes. NAMI member, former president of NAMI Multnomah Board of Directors. Part of the problem right now is when we speak about the coordination of benefits, she just got shifted over. This is a federal issue, but they've now declined one of her medications. You've got to go through the whole appeals process and so forth and so on. But I've met many other people. This gentleman right here, he sold his house in Multnomah County, moved to Clackamas County because they had a program there that would help his daughter, which promptly got canceled. She's now out in Pendleton and has been waiting 6 months to get a transfer back in the Portland area, so it's now 700 miles for him to come do it. I've got another lady here, hospitalized because there was no place for her to go. She's bipolar. She said, I just need some place to be able to calm down so that I don't have to be hospitalized and run up the tab even more. Not available. Here's a woman who spent 2 years in the state mental hospital waiting for a community placement. It's complete. You talk about inefficiencies, there's one right there. And this gentleman spent 9 additional months waiting for a community placement. And on top of that, he says he's met other people who are afflicted with mental illness. He said the best and easiest way for them to get care is to commit a crime, to get in the prison system. So clearly there are inefficiencies in the system. Clearly there's much work to be done to make the system workable so that it serves the population. I can tell you from my experiences with many people who've come to me and told their stories, it's not. It's not effective, it's not efficient, and it's not working. We need to understand the structural problems and then get them solved. Thank you.
Question. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Bob Jundeff is, and Betsy Earls are the last two to testify. And just to let you know, we cannot move this bill today because the proponents have a couple of amendments, and so we will hopefully be moving it on Friday.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, I am Betsy Earls, representing the Oregon Psychological Association and appearing in support of Senate Bill 1089. The Oregon Psychological Association is very committed to the continued viability of the community mental health system in Oregon. As you've already heard this morning, the system needs additional resources, and you've also heard that the patient load will only increase in the next several years. So clearly we need to take a close look at how we're spending our money. In order to use any additional investments of money most effectively, we need to know specifically how current funds are being used. Many reports have been produced over the years, as you've all noted this morning. A lot of those focus on various individual aspects of the system. But the reality is that money flows to all of the same places that we see people with mental health issues coming into contact with the system. So not only do we see money flowing through the human services aspects of this system, we also see it flowing along with the people toward the judicial system, the courts, and corrections, unfortunately, veterans affairs, housing, and other areas like that. And I think that the difference you see with the study that is proposed by Senate Bill 1089 is that there would be a careful look at how the money fits together in all of those different places. There's been a little bit of conversation around the Capitol in the last couple days about why don't we just take the money that would be used for this study and put it into various programs, human services or mental health programs that clearly need the money. And I think that's a worthwhile question. But this study is not going to cost a terrible lot of money in perspective with how much some of those systems cost. And I think you could take $200,000 and put it into some program that DHS or the counties need, and I'm sure it would be well used. But it would only perpetuate the problem. It wouldn't contribute to all of us and all of you having a firm and clear look at where the whole system needs further help in the next biennium when we'll be looking at, as we've heard, very large investments. So that's all. We're committed to working with you on this bill, and thank you. Thank you for bringing it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Junda from the Oregon Advocacy Center. We advocate on behalf of people with disabilities in Oregon, particularly people with mental illness. As you know, I've been working on issues in the community mental health system with the state hospital for years. And I wanted to pick up on what Senator Mons Anderson said at the beginning, because I think you hit the nail right on the head. We know that we have a dysfunctional system. We know we have a state hospital that none of us can be proud of. And yet, what do we do about it? How do we really take the steps that are necessary to fix a problem that we have had for a long time and that we're all frustrated about? As you mentioned, Senator Mons Anderson, there's been many, many reports. And reports have been done by groups that have come together, that have brought the stakeholders together. And when we've done that, what we have gotten, I believe, is an excellent look at what those stakeholders do, that they can do a great job if they have the resources. But what we don't have is an analysis of how we can move from where we are right now to where we need to be. And this is exactly what the bill before you is designed to take the first step to do. It's something that we're going to have to do at our state hospital as well. We all want to fix it, but how do we get from here to there? And we're going to have an honest look. And it's going to have to be a look that is done by somebody who has some independence, who can produce some information that you can rely upon, state can rely upon, advocates can rely upon, so that we can all get on the same page and know that if we're going to take some of the public money, which is very dear, and we're going to invest it, that we're going to get results that we need to get. We owe it to the public who are depending upon this, not only for mental health services, but for community safety, that these dollars be spent wisely and effectively. And this is how we can go about doing it. So I'm here to support the bill.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you very much, and we will be continuing this bill on Friday. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1089, and I believe we need to get to Senate Bill 1062. So I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1062, and I'd like to call
Susan King.
Susan King. Who else should I call up with you? Okay. Mary. And Barry Lever. I used to work with her. I can't. And Catherine West. We'll have the administrator here do a description of the bill, and then Susan.
Just briefly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, you will recall Senate Bill 1062 was, we had a legislative concept, LC 17, before the committee during the interim. So the original bill that you have before you is dealing with increasing the allowable pre-hearing period of detention in a hospital or non-hospital facility for the intensive treatment of a dementia. What you have attached in your materials is the Dash 1 amendments. And the Dash 1 amendments were brought before, or being brought before you by the Nursing Association and the Certified Nurse Practitioners. Is that correct? Thank you. And the nurse specialist. Medicare, do you want me to walk through the amendments, or would you like the folks at the table?
Let's have Susan King start, okay. And then that'd be great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Senator Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Susan King, Executive Director of the Oregon Nurses Association. With me is Ann Barry Lieber, who's an adult nurse practitioner, practices at Willamette University across the street. As the committee staff indicated, we were before you sometime before the new year during the interim to talk with you about a request that we would hope you would consider in this special session. The amendments that you have in front of you would change the process that nurse practitioners would be subjected to, if you will, with respect to their prescription of drugs. Nurse practitioners in Oregon have been independently prescribing drugs since 1979, so next year it will be our 30th anniversary. Clinical nurse specialists, who are also named in the bill, another category of advanced practice nurses, have been prescribing since 2001. So their history is a little bit shorter than the nurse practitioners. Both of those categories of advanced practice nurses have track records of safety and effectiveness with respect to their care. These amendments would remove a requirement for a list of drugs to be developed by the Board of Nursing. Essentially, the list of drugs that is currently used is what is recorded or published in Drugs, Facts, and Comparisons, which is essentially all drugs approved by the FDA that have medicinal use. Those would exclude, of course, the Schedule I's, which is where you would find medicinal marijuana or any of those kinds of substances. At this point, the FDA approves a drug, but it can't be used by a nurse practitioner or clinical nurse specialist until the Board of Nursing engages in a secondary review and makes a decision whether the drug or class of drugs is appropriate for use by either of the advanced practice nurse categories. There are very few, approximately 89 drugs currently excluded. Some of those are excluded but wouldn't be used anyway, even if they were on a list. For example, general anesthetic agents would not be used by the vast majority of nurse practitioners, but they would be used by nurse anesthetists because they are the folks that are dealing with patients during procedures requiring general anesthetics. We believe that this process actually slows down the use of certain medications that are crucial by advanced practice nurses, and I would give you a couple of examples. As you all know, we're facing an increasing problem with drug-resistant bacteria and substances, if you will, that oftentimes require new antibiotics. We have a huge problem with antibiotic resistance. A nurse practitioner has a patient before him or her who requires one of the newer formulations of antibiotics for a specific infection, but that drug is not available to him or her because it hasn't yet gone through the process, which can delay the availability of that drug to both the patient and the advanced practice nurse, sometimes for several months. This is a very inefficient system. It only slows down the process because, as I said earlier, the vast majority of medications are ultimately added to the formulary. In addition, it is an expenditure of my licensure dollars and those of Ann's. It takes approximately 15% of the staff time of the advanced practice consultant with the Board of Nursing, time that could be better spent dealing with standards of practice and disciplinary issues when they arise. So we are very hopeful that our track record of safe and effective care and the contribution of advanced practice nurses to the care of Oregonians can be made more efficient if we adopt the amendments, if you adopt the amendments contained in this bill. And I'll be happy, either of us will be happy to answer questions if you have them.
I think the main question is they're concerned regarding the safety of the patient. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, I've had people, only one person, come to me and say, a physician is better trained to do this, and I'd like for you to comment on the training that a nurse practitioner and nurse specialist gets to sort of quell the fear that the safety of the patient would be in jeopardy if the Board of Nursing did not review the drugs first.
Senator Monis Anderson and members of the committee, that is not an unfamiliar question to us. The question was posed to us in 1979 when we first sought prescriptive authority and has been a number of times since then. I guess my first answer to you would be track record. I think it's quite easy to examine the outcomes that nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists achieve with their patients to show that the safety issue is not a significant concern. It is certainly true that medications pose great dangers when they are used inappropriately or they're used in inappropriate combinations, and that can happen by any provider. We made the commitment to the legislature in 1979 that any advanced practice nurse who has prescriptive authority would have a minimum of a master's degree. That was our commitment to the legislature so that they had sufficient education and training. They must have pharmacology, pharmacotherapeutics. They have to have 150 hours of supervised practice in dealing with pharmacological interventions in their patient's care. We believe that this is a good standard and that it has resulted in a very competent advanced practice community. Further, there is a periodic review of the requirements, and we have, as an organization, consistently upheld higher standards for training and education of our advanced practice nurses.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes. Senator Carter.
I've been in the legislature 24 of those 30 years, and they've never had to come before the legislature. If people have been doing something for 30 years and there are no negative effects, I don't see what the big issue is around that.
And at this point, there's no opposition signed up for the, so it must be all right. Okay, any other questions?
No,
all right. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1062 and open a public hearing on, open a work session on Senate Bill 1062. And we have the dash, are they ones?
Yes.
Dash one amendments.
I'm trying to move the dash one amendments.
Okay, Senator Carter moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1062. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1062 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
As amended?
As amended.
Okay, Senator Carter moves Senate Bill 1062 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll. Or any discussion?
Do you want me to check and see if more sense?
Okay. Yeah. Okay, we're going to see. Let clerk call the roll, and we'll see if we can get Marissa.
Senator Carter.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gordon.
Aye.
Chair Monis Anderson.
Aye. With that, Senate Bill 1062 will be moved to the floor. I will carry the bill, and I'm going to... Any other information before I close work session? Yeah. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1062 and open a work session a public hearing on Senate Bill 1075. And do you want to?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just stay right here and provide an introduction. But I would ask Jim Davis and Bob June Depp to come up and follow my presentation. Staff, do you want to?
If you'd like. Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1075 is creating a 24-member task force on mental health and addiction services for the underserved populations. Chief sponsor is Senator Gordley. She's mentioned it already, so I don't think anybody in the audience is surprised. This has an emergency clause, is effective on passage, and it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and colleagues. Just to lay down some record before we get into the testimony, I want to point out that this is a policy focused on enhancing our mental health and addiction services system as we know it, but also with an eye toward what we want it to be in an improved state for underserved populations. And so Senate Bill 1075 does set forth a state task force on mental health and addiction needs of underserved populations, including seniors, people with disabilities, and racial and ethnic populations who currently have few, if any, options within the current system but face higher affliction rates due to factors like loss, transition, and mobility, who also face situations such as misdiagnosis. And this is a task force that would develop recommendations for the Oregon Legislature to help turn around this critical lack of services for Oregonians who are sorely in need. Also, by way of background, this bill was in our previous legislative session. I don't recall the bill number. Someone here may.
971.
Thank you. The bill died in the Ways and Means Committee last session for reasons never explained publicly, to my knowledge. But the fact that we have underserved populations among seniors and people with disabilities and racial and ethnic populations as it relates to the delivery of mental health and addiction services, the fact that we have underserved should capture our attention. And beyond capturing our attention, we do need to act by putting in place this public policy. And we've heard testimony on the record today from our Department of Human Services Director, Dr. Goldberg, indicating that he sees this bill being complementary with the bill that we heard earlier, Senate Bill 1089, as proposed by Senators Carter and Bates. What I would, again, just state for the record that this is about developing a plan for a comprehensive, integrated system of mental health and addiction services for seniors, persons with disabilities, and persons in underserved racial and ethnic communities. I want to thank the proponents of the bill, Jim Davis, and many others that we will hear from today and possibly on Friday, for all of their hard work in keeping these issues alive in this building, and for working my office to make sure that there's that we have a bill in this session. And with that, Madam Chair, we can hear from our witnesses.
Okay. I'm Jim Davis, and I represent the Coalition for Responsible Treatment, which is an informal coalition that deals with issues, mental health issues of the underserved populations, also the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, United Seniors, and Save Oregon Seniors. We are very proud to join with Senator Gordley and senior and disability and minority advocates in this session to support 1075, which, as Senator Gordley said, would develop the mental health and addictions task force for the underserved populations and finally have an opportunity to take an actual responsible look at the lack of access for needed services that these populations face. We have three populations that we've outlined in this bill: seniors, people with disabilities, and ethnic minorities. They all share very similar hurdles within the mental health and addiction systems. And this task force will offer the opportunity for the players within those communities to be able to sit down and take a critical look at these very serious mental health and addiction problems they face and how they've been ignored in this system. I also want to address a comment that's being made, and I think possibly one of the reasons somebody has found their way to kill this bill in the last session, and that is, oh gee, this is just another mental health task force. But if you go back and you look at those mental health task force and the studies and the research, you will find there was little, if any, recognition of underserved populations, and little, if any, discussion of any of these populations and the problems that they were having in the system. And I would challenge any of these coalitions to come up and tell me, what are they doing for this? It is our sincere hope that if you do pass 1089, that this process will be looking at the underserved populations as a part of their analysis of the mental health and addiction system. It's a bit of a deja vu experience for us to be up here, because we were in front of the same committee last session, and I have never seen such marvelous enthusiasm for this concept. And Margaret Carter was waiting in the subcommittee for this bill to arrive, and it never arrived, and it just was killed, and we have no idea why. And this is our third session after many public forums and community forums that we've held on this subject. We are finally coming forth again, and hopefully for a successful run at this. The three underserved populations, and I'll say this, go through this very quickly, because I think all of you have heard me talk about this half a dozen times, but these underserved populations share much in common in terms of their mental health and addiction hurdles. Seniors and people with disabilities face more life adjustment hurdles than any other population, significant losses, adjustments in retirement, and they have the greatest risk of depression, anxiety, and other mental health problems, bar none. It's just a fact. And people with disabilities, and you'll find very little about their mental health problems, which is very sad, but people with disabilities suffer many of the same type of problems and hurdles, adjustments to their physical disabilities and the depression and addictions that go around that, and the fear of a double stigma. They don't oftentimes seek help because they'll say it's a double whammy, and that is sad as well. So statistics, depending on what study you read, usually show about 15-25% of the senior population have mental health problems. We gather that very similar statistics within our disability population. Since there's really no response to their problems within the mental health system, and it's really interesting. I wrote my dissertation on this topic, and the statistics haven't really changed over the decades. And because the only older people that we see in the system are people who had been in the system and grew old in the system. I mean, there's no outreach in the community that's bringing in people. It's just people are getting old in the system, and that's the only percentage of older people you have. And what happens is that the only alternatives that a lot of these people face with these serious impairments is suicide. And we have in the senior population around 13% of the population that are 65 plus, but they make up 25-30% of all suicides. And so this is a very sad thing indeed, and we're seeing very little response to this situation within the mental health community or within the addiction community, where there's virtually no response to our communities. The ethnic minority community can relate very well to this because they are having trouble accessing mental health and addiction services as well. The 2001 Surgeon General's report very clearly stated that African Americans, Hispanics, Native Americans, and Asian Americans face a much higher rate of mental illness and addiction than other populations, yet they are facing serious roadblocks within the mental health and addiction community, and often problems communicating with providers, outreach problems, discrimination, many of the same problems that our populations in the senior and disability community are facing. So we are hoping that this bill will finally pass, so that, and Senator Gordley, I couldn't have said it better, in terms of what our goals are, to begin to look at early intervention approaches, in particular around assessment, outreach, individual and group therapy, and support groups, peer counseling, education, the type of preventative approaches that really do work with our population. And we saw it in the senior and addiction projects that we had for 12 years in the state before they were eliminated in 2001, and we saw the tremendous impact that those preventative efforts have. I did want to say, and I can't express my disappointment enough, that We are very concerned with the fact that this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. First of all, because of what happened to it last time, but second of all, we totally amended this bill last session with the help of Senator Gordley and her office. We totally amended this bill so that virtually every cost was taken out. I mean, and the Addictions and Mental Health Division promised that they would provide a staff support. We'd like to see SPD involved as well. And so we don't see where the costs are in this thing, and we do not want to see you go back down to Ways and Means and get killed again. We just don't see how there can be any cost. And I'll tell you, we'll raise the money if we have to. You know, there is very little cost to this, and it just really worries me that there is this kind of referral when there's virtually no cost associated.
Chair. Yes, Senator Morissette.
Thank you. I had a discussion with the fiscal office yesterday regarding a proposed fiscal impact, a questionable fiscal impact on another bill. And I was told that, well, you, first of all, you talk to the department, to the agency, to SPD, to whomever, and make sure that they say there's no fiscal impact, and then you have them call. Now, you need a senator to work with you, but then you go back to the fiscal and try to iron that out. And I remember last year, and I appreciate your, you know, stick-to-itiveness, so to speak, but I would pursue that, and I would be very happy to help you pursue that, and I think the sponsor of the bill would be happy, because sometimes these are kind of bogus roadblocks that we face. Now, if the department says there is no fiscal, then there shouldn't be a fiscal if they can handle that with available staff. So I would be happy to work with you in that. And,
Senator Morissette, Madam Chair, we've worked with the department in the past. They came in one session and put a $160,000 price tag on this task force, which was a joke, because we could have run a statewide campaign with that kind of money. But last time, the last session, there was a cooperation, and there shouldn't be any great cost. So we hope that is removed and that we can just move forward with this. Our hope, just in closing, our hope is that we can get the players together on this task force, legislators, providers, advocates, the players in the community, a lot of them are in the audience right now, and begin, at least preliminarily, to make recommendations to the 2009 session and begin our work immediately to make movement in this area. So we have universal support, as far as we know, from senior, disability, mental health, minority communities for this effort, and they would be fully involved. So we strongly ask your support for Senate Bill 1075 and to be able to move it straight to the floor.
Thank you.
Bob. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Junda from Oregon Advocacy Center. We advocate on behalf of people with disabilities across the state. First of all, I'd like to thank Jim Davis and particularly Senator Gordley for her work on this bill. I think it is very needed. And the reason is that these are particular problems in a dysfunctional mental health system that stand out. And I think that one of the reasons they stand out is that they just haven't gotten the attention that they need. And I thought I would take an opportunity to just give you some examples of why that is. Before I do that, I just want to say that I believe that Senate Bill 1089 that we earlier discussed and Senate Bill 1075 are actually they are closely linked. And it's the type of information that can be developed through 1089 that can effectively inform the work of the group that would be set up in 1075. So quickly, when we talk about seniors, of course, there's many, many issues, and Jim has talked about those. I just want to bring up two, and one is that when you read the Oregon State Hospital report, we all know that part of the state hospital is a unit called the Gero Psych Unit, and that the people who live in that part of the state hospital are people primarily with dementia, which is the result of aging and disability, and people with brain injury. And when you read about some of the problems of infection control at the hospital, And particularly, and there was a great deal of attention given to hand washing as being a problem there. But when you think about infection control, think about the medically challenged folks in the geropsych unit with these very challenging behaviors and challenging disabilities. That's the group we're talking about. And an associated piece of that is that there is a system that has been developed for this group of people to help them move into community facilities so that when their behaviors are stabilized and their medical situations are stabilized, that they can spend the rest of their lives, most likely, in more comfortable environment with proper care. But this is particularly an area that we have had difficulty in having adequate funding for, you know, the development of those facilities for those folks. And it's an area that just hasn't gotten a lot of attention. And I think that that's one of the things that this task force should be looking at. In terms of people with disabilities, as you know, the state government is siloed. Even though we've tried to bring together Department of Human Services, it's still broken up into different areas. And I have many, many stories of people with developmental disabilities who can't get mental health services through the community mental health system because the providers believe that, well, those folks should be served in that other system, even though their needs are particularly mental health services. And this is a problem that people with disabilities in general have, is being viewed by particular service systems as unservable or folks not having the expertise to serve them, when in fact they are eligible for those services, they have an entitlement to be served, and they need an accommodation to be served. But our systems aren't designed to do that. And it's a complicated problem. It's one that this task force should be looking at. Offenders with mental illness are particularly mentioned, and as we all know, having adequate mental health services is something that can bring us increased community safety and make sure that people are linked into services that they need so that we're not spending taxpayers' dollars and housing people in prisons and jails that are inadequately staffed and funded to provide them with services. We can do much better in the community, and we've just got to figure out how to do that. The last one I wanted to mention was ethnic minorities. My observation is that this is an area that's always been challenging in Oregon, and the big question is cultural competency and outreach. And it really has been a matter of priority. This is an area where we need to prioritize to bring services to those communities, and without specific attention to how we go about doing that and adequately resourcing it, we're not going to get there. So that's why I support Senate Bill 1075.
Great. Questions? We have a number of people who want to testify, so
thank
let's keep moving on. Let's bring up the department, Len Ray from Addictions Mental Health. And then Verna Porter and Bob Lawrence, do you want to come up too so that you're ready to go when Len's done?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Len Ray, and I'm the administrator of Adult Mental Health Services, Addictions and Mental Health with the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to provide some testimony on Senate Bill 1075. As Dr. Goldberg provided in earlier testimony, the department does support the efforts to expand services to meet the needs of the underserved identified population. We all know that as the baby boomer population matures, the mental health needs for older adults and that population will grow. The Department of Human Services also seeks to better serve people with disabilities who have mental health issues. I concur with Mr. Jundeff that as Oregon continues to become a more ethnically diverse state, addiction and mental health services need to be responsive to these particular changes. The department is supportive of the concepts in the bill and believes the identified populations would benefit from the provisions of Senate Bill 1075. We believe that there is a fiscal impact, it's going to be in the support staff for this particular committee. So we'd want to work closely to see what level of support this particular committee would need for that.
With that coming, I'm sorry, Senator Gurley wasn't here. I'd be most comfortable then to wait to move this bill once we have the fiscal statement from legislative fiscal. So just to let the committee know that.
Thank you.
All right, Brennan, Porter.
Madam Chair, Mona Sanderson, and members of the committee, I'm Verna Porter. I'm with the Oregon Alliance for Retired Americans, among other advocacy groups for seniors. And I'm here to. I am a retired geriatric nurse, so I know about the issue very well. Observed it and worked with it for years. But as a retiree advocate, I'm seeing something different happen. I'm seeing people retire, then not having the insurance coverage of any kind. And when they do get onto Medicare, if they do need help with mental illness problems and or addiction problems, very often they go together. Very often there's a dual diagnosis. Say a bipolar person who gets into addiction issues, sometimes because the medication kind of nudges it that way. Anyway, what we're seeing, as was already mentioned, we have the baby boomers kicking in, more and more retirees, more and more people uninsured, unable to help for ask for the assistance they need on these mental health and addiction problems. Then something we've observed over the years, it seems that when people do retire, the change in lifetime patterns seems to give these problems a nudge. Very often a person with some mental disorder, it doesn't show until retirement, and then it goes into place. I think preventive medicine here, and I'm talking about care in early stages, is such a vital part of, if not cure, maintenance, keeping things in check. It isn't happening. Even when the people do get to Medicare and get Medicare coverage, addiction and mental illness, there's a 50% copay. Pensions have eroded so badly people can't afford much medical coverage, if any, many times. So I'm seeing a huge problem now. I see it developing even further. They tell us on the alcohol and addiction problems, if left untreated, what seems to be a healthy person at retirement at 65 is usually dead by 72.
They're oh, man.
I know. No, I do.
So my advice is not retire.
I was going to say, make sure when you do retire that you have good medical health coverage, as I do, thank God, because I'm healthy and here to testify, and I'm going to pass 72 on Monday, and it is because I do have good health coverage. So many of our people do not have it. And then, very importantly, I guess what I'm trying to say is let's have parity between mental health and other health in all ways, and that is for our retirees as well. And I think maybe I covered it there. I got my point across, and thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Porter.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bob Lawrence, and I'm the Legislative Coordinator for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I am submitting this testimony on behalf of the Commission, which has offered its support of this bill. The Commission would also like to deeply laud Senator Gordley for her continued work and persistence in the mental health field for all populations. Her weekly meetings have been a real inspiration to all of us, and I appreciate the knowledge base. For the past decade, our commission has advocated for the mental health and addiction needs of older adults. In 2001, the commission published a study of the mental health and addiction needs of Oregon's baby boomers. And I'm going to do a small quote, but the whole report is available, which is very interesting. Just a small quote will give you some indication of what we were talking about in 2001. Quote, "We must prepare for the largest elderly population in American history within a decade. The recommendations in this report include steps to address the problems of access to treatment services, inadequate education and prevention efforts, and insufficient training and support for both professional and family caregivers. We must prepare for the increased needs of the 21st century. How well we prepare will be a measure of our healthcare system and our society as a whole." I think we all know what Yogi Berra would say to that particular quote. A few of the recommendations of the report have been implemented fully or in part. Sadly, we have not done nearly enough as a state to meet the increased demands on our addictions and mental health system placed by the baby boomer generation and an aging population. And the cost in dollars and the cost in lives is growing. Mental illness affects approximately 1 in 5 American families. The National Alliance on Mental Health estimates that untreated mental illnesses cost the U.S. more than $100 billion per year. And traditionally, Oregon's is usually 1% of a figure like that, which would be $1 billion for the state of Oregon. It would be nice to avoid those costs at all possible. Untreated mental illness has an impact on our abuse rates in Oregon, our health care costs, and our public safety system. In 2004, Oregon ranked fourth among all states in older adult suicide rates. Both nationally and in Oregon, older adult suicide rates are the highest among any age group. We know that the mental health system in Oregon is grossly underfunded. We appreciate that the legislature has invested time, resources, and money into the mental health system. You have done so to solve some of what appear to be the most pressing problems in our mental health system, the state hospital ensuring adequate mental health services for children and shoring up a crumbling community mental health system at the county level. These are important problems, but do not let the seniors and people with disabilities go by the wayside. The Governor's Commission was successful in winning passage of Senate Bill 781 in the 2005 legislature. It was an unfunded mandate, unfortunately. That bill required that older adults be treated as a distinct population and that the state begin to craft strategies to ensure the mental health needs of older adults are met. But to date, we have only taken incremental steps in meeting those needs. Last year, with your help, Senator Mona Sanderson, particularly, we brought forward Senate Bill 847 to fund 4 pilot projects to train mental health specialists in geriatrics. Despite the small price tag, the bill was not passed by Ways and Means. Chair Mona Sanderson, Senate Bill 1075 is important, not because we don't know what the solutions are. It's important because it's time for seniors, people with disabilities, and other underserved populations to be heard and have their interests addressed. The Task Force on Mental Health and Addiction Services for Underserved Populations is a vehicle by which these needs may be addressed. Thank you for your patience and time.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank this particular panel for your comments on the bill. And with Mr. Ray still here, I also want to address the statement that we have from you and the Department of Human Services. I'm going to tell you, you're going to hear some impatience in my voice because I'm mindful of how long Senator Carter has worked on these issues, well over 20 years. Always, always a champion for the underserved, Senator Carter. The underserved are often, too often, the last to be considered, the last. And in fact, it's ironic that this issue, this bill, was bumped to last on the agenda today. Just a little irony. And what I am also mindful of, and I can say this in all honesty, were it not for the presence of Senator Carter and myself on this committee and in this body, these issues would not come forward. They would not come forward. They would not be addressed. And I say that to say to the department, you're the messenger coming to us with a statement about how in order for the department to carry out this work, it will require additional resources. And I want to send a message back to the department through you, Mr. Ray, and particularly given what we heard from Dr. Goldberg in support of the bill. This work must go forward. This work must be done within existing resources. I don't buy the ways and means, all of that to the side. This is work that must be that must go forward. This is about putting in place a task force that can do some work that will produce policies that are right and just and correct to serve the underserved. There no more excuses. No more excuses. The department must take on this work. And, Madam Chair, I'm asking that we give that direction to the department, that they take on this work and do it within existing resources.
Thank you, Senator Gurley. Do you want to respond?
Senator Gurley.
And bring the mic to you.
Senator Gurley and members of the committee, thank you very much for your response. And I will take that message back exactly as you've said it. I appreciate it. Thank you.
And Senator Gurley, we have not received a fiscal statement, and now that the department has this information, I think that we will proceed waiting for the actual fiscal statement from Legislative Fiscal, and then we'll deal with it once we have that in front of us.
I hope, Madam Chair, and this is with all due respect to what you have just said for the record, if I can interpret that to mean that once we have that information that we're going to act, we're going to be proactive and we're going to move this forward, then I accept what you're saying. We need to move this policy forward in this session.
Senator Morissette.
I agree. I totally agree with Senator Gordley. We need to move this. And I agree. It can be done. It should be done within the department. Existing resources.
Thank
it should
you.
Have been done last time.
Senator Carter.
Madam Chair, I'd like to say to Mr. Ray, who is the messenger, so please know that I'm not going to shoot you down. This further points out, just talking with my colleague and my friend, Senator Cruz, you know, this is as much about poverty as it is ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And what bothers me is that I don't care if Senator Gordley or I never showed up at the Oregon Legislature. This just shows me that our priorities are not in the right place in this state. We should not have to have a task force that says to the department, you need to do that. This needs to be a sense of consciousness in the Department of Human Services. Because when you say human, you're not dividing it along color line, racial line, economic lines, or anything else. And why should older people for whose backs that many of us have walked on, whose shoulders many of us have walked on, whose backs have been bowed for some time, have to beg and plead at the end of life for something that they should have as a matter of the decency that those of us who come along later should be looking out for? I don't get it, folk. I'm talking to all Oregonians. I'm talking to all of us in this room. I mean, it says no wonder people commit suicide. That the very country in which I work for to help toil and work hard for and make it a decent society have now thrown me by the wayside. No wonder people want to commit suicide. And no wonder people feel have levels of dementia that they can't be in control of, because everybody else is so busy living their lives, popping their fingers, living high, that they don't care about them anymore, even though they were the ones who helped make America strong and America great. We're talking about the most vulnerable of our population here. And how we can say, well, we're going to help this one
because she's one color, and this one because her hair is a certain color, and this one because her situation is not as bad. We're not going to help this kid because he lives down in Canyonville. I don't get it. Help me to better understand this issue. And I'm saying to my colleagues who don't look like Senator Gordley and me, somewhere along the line, you need to step up to the plate. Because you can't call yourself a leader in this state and you leave some of Oregon's people out, and especially the most vulnerable. Thank you, Madam Chair, for my...
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And in all due respect, Margaret, you know me well enough to know that I don't see any difference between you and me.
Mm-hmm.
And but if you look historically, go back to 1850, half the state budget was for mental health. Half the state budget was for mental health. And look where we've come. Margaret and I had talked about, you know, I'm fully supportive of this, by the way. And I'm fully supportive of the fact that it shouldn't take a damn dime to do it. But the point is, I mean, you want to talk about culture. Culture, the cultural divide in this state is not based on color lines. It absolutely is not. I've got a whole lot of poor folks in my part of the state who feel absolutely as disconnected as the poor folks in your part of the state. You know that. So, and it's something that needs to be addressed. I mean, we've got a lot of folks who just don't feel that the system's there for them. They're intimidated by it. They don't know how to access it. And that's the fault of the system. And, you know, it's time. It's like I said on the last bill, mental health is the most important issue we're going to deal with in 2009, bar none. I've made that commitment. I'll continue to make that commitment, and I'm going to be on that stump every chance I have because it is the broken system that is so broke right now that if we don't do something, it's going to disappear. It flat out is. And the cost at that point is something not just in dollars and cents, but in people is a cost we cannot afford. We are lamenting at this point the fact that Senator Gordley will not be serving in the body next session. I've been lamenting that for a year now. But trust me, the good senator is going to be here helping us as we move forward, and we need to keep this on the front burner. And this isn't a partisan issue; it's a people issue.
And Senator Morrison,
yeah, I'll take up where you left off on the damn dime bit. For the last four sessions, I have had a bill that would raise the beer tax by a dime. A glass.
That wasn't an opening for that. That was an opening.
And the money that would come from that would go to addiction and mental health treatment at the local level. Now, unfortunately, by the paper this morning, Lane County is about to lay off 100 workers because the timber tax is not coming through.
Yeah.
We are cutting services, and these services are delivered at the local level. Now, there's a lot of aspects to mental health, but I think one of the most important is to keep people at the local level out of, you know, the emergency room, the jail, and so on, and that is outpatient service and so on. And we may have to look for an additional source of revenue. And I will pursue that aspect of it, but I have worked with the mental health people over the last couple of years on the addiction problem and mental health, and they go together. I mean, it isn't, you know, mental health and addiction are treated, you know, it's a common problem for people who have either of those afflictions. So this is something that we will work on, and I am dedicated to continue the fight. So thank you.
I'm not really defending DHS, but I want this task force to be run well. And it will take, for a 24-member task force, two people. Two people. And therefore, that's where you're getting to the, well, I would think
and depending on how many meetings and how much time and all of that, I can see where you're coming from. You just don't have the resources to spread thin the staff that we already have. But so take that into consideration, that we are on the bandwagon for mental health, for the minorities, for the poor, for whether it's ethnic or money or language barriers or whatever. We want to proceed, and that's why I want to wait until Friday to have you in 24 or 48 hours figure out what that fiscal is actually going to be, because we do have to have other agencies haven't stepped forward and said we will staff this task force. It falls on DHS to staff it. So we truly want it. We have to have a clear picture of the cost of it, but we certainly don't want it to die in Ways and Means, and we know that it did, and we know probably the revenue forecast may not be favorable on Friday when we receive it, but with all that taken into account.
Madam Chair, one aspect of that might be to take a look at the legislatively funded FTE in the department that are still vacant. There might be some funding there.
Exactly. You have an Office of Multicultural Health, for example, that's minus a director and another staff person.
Yeah. So there's
those are vacancies. There is a will, there is a way. We can do this.
Okay.
You can do it.
Chair Lana Sanderson and members of the committee, you will have information by Friday.
Thank you very much. Okay. And that means we will have a legislative fiscal impact on our desk, and then we will deal with it. Okay. We have 10 minutes left, and we have 6 people left. Are there any that, just raise your hand, that could come back Friday, since we will be, so Mary can come back Friday. Okay. Catherine can come back Friday. John can come back Friday.
Nicole
can come back Friday. So all
Bennett
we
can come back.
Oh, Bennett can come back.
Is there a Bill Olson?
How about Bill Olson? Olson.
Madam Chair, Bill Olson had to leave for a meeting, but I have submitted a letter in regard to.
So he can come back for. Oh no. But we will have his letter.
You have his letter.
Okay. Excellent. Oh well, then with that, at least one of you could come testify. You're excused. Mary, do you want to come up? Mary's going to come up and wrap us up, and then I just want to review a couple of things for the committee.
And I'm going to be so brief you might be able to get two. Mary Botkin, American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. I just want to say this is a great bill. It shouldn't go to Ways and Means to pass. We want to do two things. We want to add some employee people to this group, and we want to add some corrections people. And we talked to Jim, and he's fine with that. We can
could
do
could
it
you,
officially.
I think you need to do it officially, so it's actually in yeah. statute. So
and,
you would
but
work
I don't
want
to slow the bill down either. If
you're no, you're probably
to
able to have the amendments, work with Senator yeah. Gordley to add people from,
and
if
I want to
she,
thank
it's
Senator
her bill.
Gordley for all of her work, mm-hmm. and Senator Carter. I don't know, oh, and Senator Cruz as well. I have to say, I don't know where we would be without you. This is very distressing, and we continue to do the same thing session after session after session, and we don't seem to get anywhere. Thank you very much for your work,
okay.
Senator, and I'm done.
Okay. John, do you want to come up?
Go, John.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and we work on behalf of low-income people statewide, and want to begin just by thanking Senator Cruz and Senator Carter for acknowledging the issue of low-income people as well in this discussion. But I'm here today because I did testify last session on Senate Bill 975, and my testimony was really informed by 31 years of working on the local level and seeing what it means to have underserved people in the community where there are not resources and not a focus on taking care of those issues at the local level. So I just think in closing, this is a really important issue, and it's a good concept, a way of dealing with it, and it should have modest to no cost, and I'm happy to be very much in support of it. And I want to again thank Senator Gordley for continuing to pursue this issue. And I have to also thank my friend and colleague, Jim Davis. We had these discussions beginning back in the 1970s sometime.
Wow. Oh, you're old.
Thank you very much.
All right. Rick, can you... There's 8 minutes left.
Catherine White.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations, AARP, Oregon. As a parent of an adult daughter who deals with a mental health issue every day and as a representative of an organization with over 500,000 members here in Oregon who are 50 years old or older, we definitely understand the concerns that this bill is trying to address, and we offer our support for it. One thing I would just add is that I believe all of you, your offices at least, received this material yesterday, and it outlines the campaign for seniors and people with disabilities. A number of advocacy organizations are participating in that campaign, and Senate Bill 1075 is one of the action items for us this session. Thank you.
Senator Murtha.
And Verna Porter said that the solution to part of the solution to the problem is not to retire. Do you believe that is true, AARP?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Continue to stay active.
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition on Developmental Disabilities. And I just want to express our strong support for both 1075 and 1089. Increasingly, people with developmental disabilities are being identified as having mental health conditions. In our past history of people with developmental disabilities, folks were often drugged to the point that the real cause of many of their behaviors and some of the issues were never aware of them, and we've just begun that process of really identifying people. The most costly people coming into the system right now are people who are dual diagnosed with intellectual disabilities and mental health issues. They are very, very costly. They are driving our budget. We have created a task force, a white paper group, to look at what we need to be doing in responding to a system with these very, very, very complex people. So the information is out there. The information on best practice is out there. We're moving ahead and addressing some of those issues. But just as recently as a month ago, I had a DD program manager, the head of a DD program in a county, tell me that they had called their local mental health provider, who told them that no, they did not serve people with intellectual disabilities, that people with developmental disabilities were simply not eligible for mental health treatment. Mm-hmm. We discovered that many people were unaware that there is a special publication that is designed to help mental health providers understand how to work with people with intellectual disabilities. So we are in strong support of this issue. I think we always have to remember the bleed over into all our other silos that occurs as a result of mental health conditions. So anything that we can do in our support for this legislation and our support for the task forces and the work groups, we are there because this is all of our problem and all of our issues.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1075. And colleagues, on Friday at 10, we have a conference call with Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson. So Senate Bill 1100 will be first, because we do have that conference call, and there is opposition to the bill, and so that might be lengthy. And then we will hopefully be able to not take much time with Senate Bill 1075, and it shouldn't be able to take much time with Senate Bill 1089 because the amendments just weren't ready, but they will be ready.
Okay. So Madam Chair,
yes,
I would like to recognize Randy Prince, who is in the audience, for people from my constituent. Randy, would you tell us who you their people are?
These are cadets from the Willamette Leadership Academy. We're a charter school in the Fern Ridge School District. We have a half dozen of our government students, spending state and federal government, and some of our social studies students.
Okay.
Welcome.
Welcome, and I will meet with you immediately after this is over.
And hopefully some of you may be behind the diocese like we are someday.
Right.
All right.
Or maybe you'll make better choices. I don't know.
Okay.